Side 6. Side 6. At night in the inns, sharing the principal guest chamber with her husband, and conscious that Walter, lying on his camp bed a few feet away from her, lay awake, she dug her teeth in the pillow so that no sound might escape her. But in the daytime, protected by the curtains of her chair, she allowed herself to give way. Her pain was so great that she could have screamed at the top of her voice. She had never known that one could suffer so much, and she asked herself desperately what she had done to deserve it. She could not make out why Charlie did not love her. It was her fault, she supposed, but she had done everything she knew to make him fond of her. They had always got on so well. They laughed all the time they were together. They were not only lovers, but good friends. She could not understand. She was broken. She told herself that she hated and despised him, but she had no idea how she was going to live if she was never to see him again. If Walter was taking her to Mei Tan Fu as a punishment, he was making a fool of himself. For what did she care now what became of her? She had nothing to live for anymore. It was rather hard to be finished with life at 27. Chapter 29. On the steamer that took them up the Western River, Walter read incessantly, but at mealtimes he endeavoured to make some kind of conversation. He talked to her as though she were a stranger with whom he happened to be making the journey, of indifferent things, from politeness, Kitty imagined, or because, so he could render more marked, the gulf that separated them. In a flash of insight, she had told Charlie that Walter had sent her to him with the threat of divorce as the alternative to her accompanying him to the stricken city, in order that she might see for herself how indifferent, cowardly, and selfish he was. It was true. It was a trick which accorded very well with his sardonic humour. He knew exactly what would happen, and he had given her armour necessary instructions before her return. She had caught in his eyes a disdain which seemed to include her lover as well as herself. He said to himself, perhaps, that if he had been in Townsend's place, nothing in the world would have hindered him from making any sacrifice to gratify her smallest whim. She knew that was true also. But then, when her eyes were opened, how could he make her do something which was so dangerous, and which he must know frightened her so terribly? At first she thought he was only playing with her, until they actually started, no, later, till they left the river and took to the chairs for the journey across country. She thought he would give that little laugh of his and tell her that she need not come. She had no inkling what was in his mind. He could not really desire her death. He had loved her so desperately. She knew what love was now, and she remembered 1,000 signs of his adoration. For him, really, in the French phrase, she did make fine weather and foul. It was impossible that he did not love her still. Did you cease to love a person because you had been treated cruelly? She had not made him suffer as Charlie had made her suffer. And yet, if Charlie made a sign, notwithstanding everything, even though she knew him now, she would abandon all the world had to offer and fly to his arms. Even though he had sacrificed her and cared nothing for her, even though he was callous and unkind, she loved him. At first she thought that she had only to bide her time, and sooner or later Walter would forgive her. She had been too confident of her power over him to believe that it was gone forever. Many waters could not quench love. He was weak if he loved her, and felt that love her he must. But now she was not quite sure. When in the evening he sat reading, in the straight-backed blackwood chair of the inn, with the light of a hurricane lamp on his face, she was able to watch him at her ease. She lay on the pallet on which her bed presently would be set, and she was in shadow. Those straight regular features of his made his face look very severe. You could hardly believe that it was possible for them on occasion to be changed by so sweet a smile. He was able to read as calmly as though she were 1,000 miles away. She saw him turn the pages, and she saw his eyes move regularly as they travelled from line to line. He was not thinking of her. And when, the table being set and dinner brought in, he put aside his book and gave her a glance, not knowing how the light on his face threw into distinctness his expression, she was startled to see in his eyes a look of physical distaste. Yes, it startled her. Was it possible that his love had left him entirely? Was it possible that he really designed her death? It was absurd. That would be the act of a madman. It was odd, the little shiver that ran through her, as the thought occurred to her that perhaps Walter was not quite sane. Chapter 30. Suddenly her bearers, long silent, began to speak, and one of them, turning round, with words she could not understand, and with a gesture, sought to attract her attention. She looked in the direction he pointed, and there on the top of a hill saw an archway. She knew by now that it was a memorial in compliment of a fortunate scholar or a virtuous widow. She had passed many of them since they left the river. But this one, silhouetted against the westering sun, was more fantastic and beautiful than any she had seen. Yet, she knew not why, it made her uneasy. It had a significance which she felt, but could not put into words. Was it a menace that she vaguely discerned, or was it derision? She was passing a grove of bamboos, and they leaned over the causeway strangely, as if they would detain her. Though the summer evening was windless, their narrow green leaves shivered a little. It gave her the sensation that someone hidden among them was watching her as she passed. Now they came to the foot of the hill, and the rice fields ceased. The bearers took it with a swinging stride. The hill was covered close with little green mounds, close, close to one another, so that the ground was ribbed like the sea sand when the tide has gone out. And this she knew too, for she had passed just such a spot as they approached each populous city and left it. It was the graveyard. Now she knew why the bearers had called her attention to the archway that stood on the crest of the hill. They had reached the end of their journey. They passed through the archway, and the chair-bearers paused to change the pole from shoulder to shoulder. One of them wiped his sweating face with a dirty rag. The causeway wound down. There were bedraggled houses on each side. Now the night was falling. But the bearers, on a sudden, broke into excited talk, and, with a jump that shook her, ranged themselves as near as they could to the wall. In a moment she knew what had startled them, for as they stood there, chattering to one another, 4 peasants passed, quick and silent, bearing a new coffin, unpainted, and its fresh wood gleamed white in the approaching darkness. Kitty felt her heart beat in terror against her ribs. The coffin passed, but the bearers stood still. It seemed as though they could not summon up the will to go on. But there was a shout from behind, and they started. They did not speak now. They walked for a few minutes longer, and then turned sharply into an open gateway. The chair was set down. She had arrived. Chapter 31. It was a bungalow, and she entered the sitting room. She sat down while the coolies, straggling in one by one, brought in their loads. Walter in the courtyard gave directions where this or that was to be placed. She was very tired. She was startled to hear an unknown voice. "May I come in?" She flushed and grew pale. She was overwrought, and it made her nervous to meet a stranger. A man came out of the darkness, for the long low room was lit only by a shaded lamp, and held out his hand. "My name is Waddington. I'm the Deputy Commissioner." "Oh, the customs. I know. I heard that you were here." In that dim light, she could see only that he was a little thin man, no taller than she, with a bald head and a small, bare face. "I live just at the bottom of the hill, but coming in this way you wouldn't have seen my house. I thought you'd be too fagged to come and dine with me, so I've ordered your dinner here and I've invited myself." "I'm delighted to hear it." "You'll find the cook's not bad. I kept on Watson's boys for you." Watson was the missionary who was here. Yes, very nice fellow. I'll show you his grave tomorrow if you like. How kind you are, said Kitty with a smile. At that moment, Walter came in. Waddington had introduced himself to him before coming in to see Kitty, and now he said, I've just been breaking it to your missus that I'm dining with you. Since Watson died, I haven't had anybody much to talk to but the nuns, and I can never do myself justice in French. Besides, there's only a limited number of subjects you can talk to them about. I've just told the boy to bring in some drinks, said Walter. The servant brought whiskey and soda, and Kitty noticed that Waddington helped himself generously. His manner of speaking and his easy chuckle had suggested to her when he came in that he was not quite sober. Here's luck, he said. Then turning to Walter, you've got your work cut out for you here. They're dying like flies. The magistrate's lost his head, and Colonel Yu, the officer commanding the troops, is having a devil of a job to prevent them from looting. If something doesn't happen soon, we shall all be murdered in our beds. I tried to get the nuns to go, but of course they wouldn't. They all want to be martyrs, damn them. He spoke lightly, and there was in his voice a sort of ghostly laughter so that you could not listen to him without smiling. Why haven't you gone? Asked Walter. Well, I've lost half my staff, and the others are ready to lie down and die at any minute. Somebody's got to stay and keep things together. Have you been inoculated? Yes, Watson did me, but he did himself too, and it didn't do him much good, poor blighter. He turned to Kitty, and his funny little face was gaily puckered. I don't think there's any great risk if you take proper precautions. Have your milk and water boiled, and don't eat fresh fruit or uncooked vegetables. Have you brought any gramophone records with you? No, I don't think so, said Kitty. I'm sorry for that. I was hoping you would. I haven't had any for a long time, and I'm sick of my old ones. The boy came in to ask if they would have dinner. You won't dress tonight, will you? Asked Waddington. My boy died last week, and the boy I have now is a fool, so I haven't been dressing in the evening. I'll go and take off my hat, said Kitty. Her room was next door to that in which they sat. It was barely furnished. An armour was kneeling on the floor, the lamp beside her, unpacking Kitty's things. Chapter 32. The dining room was small, and the greater part of it was filled by an immense table. On the walls were engravings of scenes from the Bible and illuminated texts. Missionaries always have large dining tables, Waddington explained. They get so much a year more for every child they have, and they buy their tables when they marry, so that there shall be plenty of room for little strangers. From the ceiling hung a large paraffin lamp, so that Kitty was able to see better what sort of a man Waddington was. His baldness had deceived her into thinking him no longer young, but she saw now that he must be well under 40. His face, small under a high, rounded forehead, was unlined and fresh-coloured. It was ugly like a monkey's, but with an ugliness that was not without charm. It was an amusing face. His features, his nose and his mouth, were hardly larger than a child's, and he had small, very bright blue eyes. His eyebrows were fair and scanty. He looked like a funny little old boy. He helped himself constantly to liquor, and as dinner proceeded it became evident that he was far from sober. But if he was drunk, it was without offensiveness, gaily, as a satyr might be who had stolen a wineskin from a sleeping shepherd. He talked of Hong Kong. He had many friends there, and he wanted to know about them. He had been down for the races a year before, and he talked of ponies and their owners. By the way, what about Townsend? He asked suddenly. Is he going to become colonial secretary? Kitty felt herself flush, but her husband did not look at her. I shouldn't wonder, he answered. He's the sort that gets on. Do you know him? Asked Walter. Yes, I know him pretty well. We travelled out from home together once. From the other side of the river, they heard the beating of gongs and the clatter of firecrackers. There, so short away from them, the great city lay in terror, and death, sudden and ruthless, hurried through its tortuous streets. But Waddington began to speak of London. He talked of the theatres. He knew everything that was being played at the moment, and he told them what pieces he had seen when he was last home on leave. He laughed as he recollected the humour of this low comedian, and sighed as he reflected on the beauty of that star of musical comedy. He was pleased to be able to boast that a cousin of his had married one of the most celebrated. He had lunched with her, and she had given him her photograph. He would show it to them when they came and dined with him at the customs. Walter looked at his guest with a cold and ironic gaze, but he was evidently not a little amused by him, and he made an effort to show a civil interest in topics of which Kitty was well aware he knew nothing. A faint smile lingered on his lips, but Kitty, she knew not why, was filled with awe. In the house of that dead missionary, over against the stricken city, they seemed immeasurably apart from all the world. Three solitary creatures and strangers to each other. Dinner was finished, and she rose from the table. "Do you mind if I say good night to you? I'm going to bed."
"I'll take myself off. I expect the doctor wants to go to bed too," answered Waddington. "We must be out early tomorrow."
He shook hands with Kitty. He was quite steady on his feet, but his eyes were shining more than ever.
"I'll come and fetch you," he told Walter, "and take you to see the magistrate and Colonel Yu, and then we'll go along to the convent. You've got your work cut out, I can tell you."
Chapter 33. Her night was tortured with strange dreams. She seemed to be carried in her chair, and she felt the swaying motion as the bearers marched with their long, uneven stride. She entered cities vast and dim, where the multitude thronged about her with curious eyes. The streets were narrow and tortuous, and in the open shops, with their strange wares, all traffic stopped as she went by, and those who bought and those who sold paused. Then she came to the memorial arch, and its fantastic outline seemed on a sudden to gain a monstrous life. Its capricious contours were like the waving arms of a Hindu god, and, as she passed under it, she heard the echo of mocking laughter. But then Charlie Townsend came towards her and took her in his arms, lifting her out of the chair, and said it was all a mistake. He had never meant to treat her as he had, for he loved her and he couldn't live without her. She felt his kisses on her mouth, and she wept with joy, asking him why he had been so cruel. But though she asked, she knew it did not matter. And then there was a hoarse, abrupt cry, and they were separated, and between, hurrying silently, coolies passed in their ragged blue, and they bore a coffin. She awoke with a start. The bungalow stood halfway down a steep hill, and from her window she saw the narrow river below her, and opposite, the city. The dawn had just broken, and from the river rose a white mist, shrouding the junks that lay moored close to one another like peas in a pod. There were hundreds of them, and they were silent, mysterious in that ghostly light, and you had a feeling that their crews lay under an enchantment, for it seemed that it was not sleep, but something strange and terrible that held them so still and mute. The morning drew on, and the sun touched the mist so that it shone whitely like the ghost of snow on a dying star. Though on the river it was light, so that you could discern palely the lines of the crowded junks and the thick forests of their masts, in front it was a shining wall the eye could not pierce. But suddenly, from that white cloud, a tall, grim and massive bastion emerged. It seemed not merely to be made visible by the all-discovering sun, but rather to rise out of nothing at the touch of a magic wand. It towered, the stronghold of a cruel and barbaric race, over the river. But the magician who built worked swiftly, and now a fragment of coloured wall crowned the bastion. In a moment, out of the mist, looming vastly and touched here and there by a yellow ray of sun, there was seen a cluster of green and yellow roofs. Huge they seemed, and you could make out no pattern. The order, if order there was, escaped you, wayward and extravagant, but of an unimaginable richness. This was no fortress, nor a temple, but the magic palace of some emperor of the gods, where no man might enter. It was too airy, fantastic, and unsubstantial to be the work of human hands. It was the fabric of a dream. The tears ran down Kitty's face, and she gazed, her hands clasped to her breast, and her mouth, for she was breathless, open a little. She had never felt so light of heart. and it seemed to her as though her body were a shell that lay at her feet, and she pure spirit. Here was beauty. She took it as the believer takes in his mouth the wafer which is God. Chapter 34. Since Walter went out early in the morning, came back at tiffin only for half an hour, and did not then return till dinner was just ready, Kitty found herself much alone. For some days she did not stir from the bungalow. It was very hot, and for the most part she lay in a long chair by the open window trying to read. The hard light of midday had robbed the magic palace of its mystery, and now it was no more than a temple on the city wall, garish and shabby, but because she had seen it once in such an ecstasy, it was never again quite commonplace, and often at dawn, or at dusk, and again at night, she found herself able to recapture something of that beauty. What had seemed to her a mighty bastion was but the city wall, and on this, massive and dark, her eyes rested continually. Behind its crenellations lay the city in the dread grip of the pestilence. Vaguely she knew that terrible things were happening there, not from Walter, who, when she questioned him, for otherwise he rarely spoke to her, answered with a humorous nonchalance which sent a shiver down her spine, but from Waddington and from the armour. The people were dying at the rate of 100 a day, and hardly any of those who were attacked by the disease recovered from it. The gods had been brought out from the abandoned temples and placed in the streets. Offerings were laid before them and sacrifices made, but they did not stay the plague. The people died so fast that it was hardly possible to bury them. In some houses, the whole family had been swept away, and there was none to perform the funeral rites. The officer commanding the troops was a masterful man, and if the city was not given over to riot and arson, it was due to his determination. He forced his soldiers to bury such as there was no one else to bury, and he had shot with his own hand an officer who demurred at entering a stricken house. Kitty sometimes was so frightened that her heart sank within her, and she would tremble in every limb. It was all very well to say that the risk was small if you took reasonable precautions. She was panic-stricken. She turned over in her mind crazy plans of escape. To get away, just to get away, she was prepared to set out as she was and make her way alone, without anything but what she stood up in, to some place of safety. She thought of throwing herself on the mercy of Waddington, telling him everything, and beseeching him to help her to get back to Hong Kong. If she flung herself on her knees before her husband and admitted that she was frightened, even though he hated her now, he must have enough human feeling in him to pity her. It was out of the question. If she went, where would she go? Not to her mother. Her mother would make her see very plainly that, having married her off, she counted on being rid of her. And besides, she did not want to go to her mother. She wanted to go to Charlie, and he did not want her. She knew what he would say if she suddenly appeared before him. She saw the sullen look of his face and the shrewd hardness behind his charming eyes. It would be difficult for him to find words that sounded well. She clenched her hands. She would have given anything to humiliate him as he had humiliated her. Sometimes she was seized with such a frenzy that she wished she had let Walter divorce her, ruining herself, if only she could have ruined him too. Certain things he had said to her made her blush with shame when she recalled them. Chapter 35. The first time she was alone with Waddington, she brought the conversation round to Charlie. Waddington had spoken of him on the evening of their arrival. She pretended that he was no more than an acquaintance of her husband. "I never much cared for him," said Waddington. "I've always thought him a bore." "You must be very hard to please," returned Kitty, in the bright, chaffing way she could assume so easily. "I suppose he's far and away the most popular man in Hong Kong." "I know. That is his stock in trade. He's made a science of popularity. He has the gift of making everyone he meets feel that he is the one person in the world he wants to see.
He's always ready to do a service that isn't any trouble to himself. And even if he doesn't do what you want, he manages to give you the impression that it's only because it's not humanly possible. That is surely an attractive trait. Charm and nothing but charm at last grows a little tiresome, I think. It's a relief, then, to deal with a man who isn't quite so delightful but a little more sincere. I've known Charlie Townsend for a good many years, and once or twice I've caught him with the mask off. You see, I never mattered, just a subordinate official in the customs, and I know that he doesn't in his heart give a damn for anyone in the world but himself. Kitty, lounging easily in her chair, looked at him with smiling eyes. She turned her wedding ring round and round her finger. Of course he'll get on. He knows all the official ropes. Before I die, I have every belief that I shall address him as Your Excellency and stand up when he enters the room. Most people think he deserves to get on. He's generally supposed to have a great deal of ability. Ability? What nonsense. He's a very stupid man. He gives you the impression that he dashes off his work and gets it through from sheer brilliancy. Nothing of the kind. He's as industrious as a Eurasian clerk. How has he got the reputation of being so clever? There are many foolish people in the world, and when a man in a rather high position puts on no frills, slaps them on the back and tells them he'll do anything in the world for them, they are very likely to think him clever. And then, of course, there's his wife. There's an able woman, if you like. She has a good sound head, and her advice is always worth taking. As long as Charlie Townsend's got her to depend on, he's pretty safe never to do a foolish thing, and that's the first thing necessary for a man to get on in government service. They don't want clever men. Clever men have ideas, and ideas cause trouble. They want men who have charm and tact, and who can be counted on never to make a blunder. Oh, yes, Charlie Townsend will get to the top of the tree all right.
I wonder why you dislike him.
I don't dislike him.
But you like his wife better, smiled Kitty.
I'm an old-fashioned little man, and I like a well-bred woman.
I wish she were well-dressed, as well as well-bred.
Doesn't she dress well? I never noticed.
I've always heard that they were a devoted couple, said Kitty, watching him through her eyelashes.
He's very fond of her. I will give him that credit. I think that is the most decent thing about him.
Cold praise.
He has his little flirtations, but they're not serious. He's much too cunning to let them go to such lengths as might cause him inconvenience. And of course he isn't a passionate man. He's only a vain one. He likes admiration. He's fat and 40 now. He does himself too well. But he was very good-looking when he first came to the colony. I've often heard his wife chaff him about his conquests.
She doesn't take his flirtations very seriously.
Oh, no. She knows they don't go very far. She says she'd like to be able to make friends of the poor little things who fall to Charlie, but they're always so common. She says it's really not very flattering to her that the women who fall in love with her husband are so uncommonly second-rate.
Chapter 36. When Waddington left her, Kitty thought over what he had so carelessly said. It hadn't been very pleasant to hear, and she had had to make something of an effort not to show how much it touched her. It was bitter to think that all he said was true. She knew that Charlie was stupid and vain, hungry for flattery, and she remembered the complacency with which he had told her little stories to prove his cleverness. He was proud of a low cunning. How worthless must she be if she had given her heart so passionately to such a man because he had nice eyes and a good figure. She wished to despise him, because so long as she only hated him, she knew that she was very near loving him. The way he had treated her should have opened her eyes. Walter had always held him in contempt. Oh, if she could only get him out of her mind altogether. And had his wife chaffed him about her obvious infatuation for him? Dorothy would have liked to make a friend of her, but that she found her second rate. Kitty smiled a little. How indignant her mother would be to know that her daughter was considered that. But at night she dreamt of him again. She felt his arms pressing her close and the hot passion of his kisses on her lips. What did it matter if he was fat and 40? She laughed with soft affection because he minded so much. She loved him all the more for his childlike vanity, and she could be sorry for him and comfort him. When she awoke, tears were streaming from her eyes. She did not know why it seemed to her so tragic to cry in her sleep. End of side 6.